98.7 FM in Chicago. You're listening to WFMT, Chicago's Fine Arts Station. The time is 10 o'clock, and now H.C. Nahigian and Sons on Golf Road in Skokie welcome you to the Studs Terkel program, heard on WFMT each weekday at this time. And here's Studs.
Well, thank you, Paul. Today is February 21st. It has been officially declared Abraham Lincoln's and George Washington's birthday, so there can be a three-day holiday. So I unofficially disavow it and undeclare it. I think February 12th is Lincoln's birthday, and February 22nd is Washington's birthday. And last February 12th, we had our annual Lincoln tribute. Tomorrow is February 22nd. We'll have our annual George Washington's birthday program. This is February 21st, and our guest this morning is Gene Shepherd, and among other observers of the human comedy, we'll have a column that appeared last Thursday of Mike Royko, Chicago Daily News, and a column of Art Hoppe that appeared last Saturday in his syndicated column in the Daily News. So in a moment, the program, Gene Shepherd first, after we hear from Paul Vodica and a word from my sponsors.
From Iran and Morocco, from India and Pakistan, from some of the most important rug-weaving centers of the world, H.C. Nahigian and Sons now have a special collection of fine hand-loomed rugs at substantial savings. There are thick-napped Moroccan rugs with striking primitive designs and lush kermans with ivory background and soft pastel floral borders. You'll find accent rugs as well in many different designs. And as the experienced personnel at H.C. Nahigian's spacious showrooms can demonstrate, these accent rugs can be used as wall decorations too. Visit H.C. Nahigian and Sons and view their entire collection. It's one of the largest on the North Shore, with rugs to fit nearly any decor. H.C. Nahigian and Sons are open daily till 5, Monday and Thursday evenings till 9, at 5140 Golf Road, just west of Old Orchard in Skokie. For information, phone Orchard 6-2500.
You know, you're driving along at 3 o'clock in the morning on the Pennsylvania Turnpike, and it's so black, there's nothing but darkness between you and the West Coast and all the way back to New York. There's not a car within 100 miles. You're booming along. You got the 8-track stereo playing in your Pontiac, and all the green lights are going off and on in your dashboard. And then all of a sudden, a little voice way down inside you says, "You should have gone in Harrisburg." And then you say to yourself, Think of other things. Think of other things. And it's getting all of a sudden more tougher and tougher to concentrate. And you think of lakes. Oh, no, not lakes. Trees. Oh, then you see a dog in your mind. You say, "My God, what am I going to do?" Your car's got $12,000 worth of accessories. And you begin to realize there's some necessities they don't put in them. Then suddenly, out of the darkness, a green and white sign appears. Headlights, pick it up. Food, telephones, lodging, restrooms, 38 miles. And you drive faster and faster, and you're watching the miles go by. You're watching that speedometer, 26 miles. Charlie's going to make it, 24 miles. And you're going 110 miles an hour, and then suddenly out of the darkness comes an orange glow. It's Howard Johnson. Oh, ramp speed, 25 miles an hour, and you go roaring in at 75. And 5 minutes later, you're lined up before that piece of porcelain with all your fellow Americans. You're at Howard Johnson's. How can you explain Howard Johnson's to Pandit Nehru?
Only one.
It's a lot more than rubber clams.
Only one voice, of course. That's Gene Shepherd, the master of radio. Gene Shepherd, the voice in the night. Gene Shepherd, who always brings something astonishing to his monologues, his views of life. That's from his new Mercury album, The Declassified Gene Shepherd.
The people have a right to know.
Right to know. This is one of the bands we'll be playing here. No doubt you'll be hearing on the Midnight Special, too. But Gene is also, he writes these classics, these great American classics. And his most recent, the others, of course, were In God We Trust, All Others Pay Cash, and The America of George Ade. Gene is from Hammond, Indiana. Not Gary. And the new one is Wanda Hickey's Night of Golden Memories and Other Disasters, Doubleday, the publishers. Where do we begin? Perhaps with Wanda Hickey and Hammond.
Well, I don't know how to begin. You know, Studs, just meeting you is so grating. You know, Everybody on these radio shows always talks about my old friend, whoever it might be.
Yeah.
Stud and I are really old friends, and we know something the others don't know. We know how great it feels to sit at night before a microphone. There's an excitement in that that is matched in no other medium.
My big problem is I'm in the morning. You see?
Well, yes, but you sit in front of that mic. It doesn't matter. When you're
it
in the studio,
yeah.
It can be any time. It's timeless in here. The studio's timeless.
I think you're right. By the way, before we talk about Wanda Hickey, and we're not only Wanda Hickey, the Bumpus family, and Diane Bigelow, and the adventures, or the non-adventures, sadly enough, of Gene Shepherd of Hammond, the nature of radio, of course.
Well, Studge, you know, these stories, I've tried in my writing, if you ask me about the classics, you know what I've tried to do in my writing? I've tried to do something that I'm afraid very few writers in America try to do, and that is to write about American life rather than American sex, or American problems, or American traumas. You see, we all live a life that's apart from the public problems that we have. We have race problems, we have this problem. We all live a daily life, like standing in line at the Carvel's, going into the parking lot at McDonald's, a life being in the library and discovering that the book you've been waiting for has just been stolen.
You know, as you're talking, Gene, I'm thinking, at first it seems though this book and your other works deal with a time past.
No.
It's with now.
No, absolutely.
But you evoke a time past.
Well,
you make it present.
I evoke a time past for all readers, including a 17-year-old reader. You see, I'm not writing about a time. At no point in my book is a time ever mentioned. I'm writing about American rituals and a ritual, Stud. The one thing about a ritual is it does continue. For example, when I say the word prom, people of all ages, from 90 to a guy who's 12, immediately it evokes a whole series of images in his mind. And that the prom remains a fairly consistent phenomenon throughout. Now here's an example. Thanksgiving dinner. These are all specifically American rituals, and all of my stories are centered around something that is a basic American ritual. The prom.
I'm thinking of the prom here.
Easter, you notice the Easter ham?
Where
do you come to that story?
That's, I'm thinking of the top.
The Bumpus family.
The Bumpus family, of course, the top, and our friend Scott Farkas.
Scott Farkas, the bully.
Oh, my God. So let's go back to the prom, because you have one here on the prom. It was
not
Daphne Bigelow you took. It was
the prom, the story on the prom is the title story in the book. That's
Wanda.
Wanda. Golden memories.
Now, Wanda was a problem for you, wasn't she?
Well, no, Wanda's a problem for all men. Yeah. See, Wanda is the girl that men settle for in their lives.
Yeah. Diane Bigelow.
Is the one that is always seen at the distance with a tall, thin man who looks like John Lindsay.
Yeah, who went to Princeton.
Yeah, that's right. Wanda Hickey is the girl who at the age of 14 is already vaguely middle-aged and is mentally the mother of four kids.
And this is Wanda you took to the prom.
Well, Wanda is the one we all took to the prom.
But something happened at that prom. This was your first dealing with bourbon, too, I think, early dealing with bourbon.
Well, see, I telescope time in in my stories. The prom, what usually happens about the time a kid goes to the prom? I mean, normally. He's about 17, right? Well, one of the things that first happens at that point is that he's beginning to have his first real social involvement with women. Now, we're not talking about the novel that's always about the first sexual experience, the first social involvement, where he appears as a couple with somebody, very officially. He's got a rented tuxedo on, this is an official thing. He's not taking her to the Orpheum, you know, to see the movies. And so this is a traumatic thing. What is another thing that happens to him about that time in life? Well, he's had his first experience with drinking, the adult thing. So the kid in this book goes in, you know, it's ritualistic. After every prom, you go to a place. You go to the Bamboo Garden, some place that is sort of a standard place where the kids of your school all
Bamboo
go.
Bamboo Gardens is a great name.
All right, Bamboo Gardens, the Red Rooster. anyway, in this story, it's the Red Rooster. So they go to the Red Rooster, and he's in his rented tuxedo with, by the way, the David Niven cummerbund, the Paisley cummerbund, which it cost him 75 cents extra to rent the Paisley one, and he's sitting there in this restaurant. And of course, now it's the night of the prom. He's official. Wanda Hickey's got her her orchid on, which, by the way, is a terrible-looking flower. Have you ever looked at an orchid? It looks like it's throwing up. It's an awful-looking flower. So she's sitting there across from him, and he's with his friend, Schwartz, you know, and in his rented tuxedo. It's a double date. And the waiter comes over and says, "Do you want something to drink for your meal?" Well, the kid can think of only one drink. It's the one his father always had. It's called a triple.
Just a triple.
So the guy says, "A triple." He says, "What kind of a triple?" He says, a triple. So 30 seconds later, he does get a triple, see? And he has seen endless numbers of drinks drunk in Western movies. You know how they do. They just toss them down. So he tosses his triple down, and 30 seconds later, he's in the John.
Yeah.
And everything he's eaten for the last month is coming up. All over his David Niven cummerbund. And the point of the story is his future has begun.
That's it. I'm thinking about that. There's so many experiences you deal with the county fair. The county fair may seem something archaic, but it isn't.
You know what that county fair is based on? What? Now, that's an interesting question. Uh-huh. It is not archaic. Uh-huh. That county fair story is based on the Flemington, New Jersey County Fair, which I attended in 1969. In other words, I'm dealing with American rituals that remain almost unchanged. For example, the county fair, the Skowhegan County Fair I went to 2 weeks ago up in Skowhegan, Maine. It's exactly the way that fair is.
I think what Gene
the
Shepard,
Midway, the whole thing.
See, what you covered, Gene, it seems to me, is an aspect of American life that is no one covers at this moment. No one really does. They may have at one time or another, but you do it.
You know why they don't? Why? Because you show that same problem. You think that it's the past. Mm-hmm. See, most writers, as soon as they become writers, move into the George
city.
Plimpton circle.
Oh, yeah, wait a minute. Don't you dare say that about me.
Yeah, that's right. They move into a circle, and they tend to believe that everything that they used to do no longer happens.
That's true. Yeah, I think you're right. There's a cutting off, and you still know the small or middle-sized town. But I thought of the county fair because of what happened to you at the prom. The county fair is the reversal of Penrod. Everything. You remember eating everything there.
That's right.
And still you... would you mind recounting that? You had everything.
Well, see, again, when you're writing, see, the kind of thing I do, I don't write, I try to telescope an experience. So when I have the people go to the county fair, I don't have them just, like in reality, you would go and you would, maybe once you'd have something to eat, or you'd go on one or two rides. But I want to telescope the whole experience. So I have them do everything. And I do it in absolute detail. For example, the chicken betting contest, where they have a chicken and you have to bet what hole he's going to go into to get the grains of corn, you know. And everything in there is based on a real fair, which happens to be a contemporary fair.
Yeah, I'm thinking about the food you ate.
The food, yeah.
And then what finally happened toward the
end. Well, here's what he wants. This is a quotation from page 80, and the title of this story is called County Fair, which originally appeared in Playboy. It says, the moment was to become a sacred gem in the family archives. The more it was told, the greater the feat became. Caleb grew into Paul Bunyan, and the old man's hammer swing rose to Olympic proportions. It wasn't until I was 16 that I read an article in Popular Mechanics and discovered that the Barker operated the thing with his foot. The old man, unfortunately, never found out. You know that trick when you hit the thing?
Yeah.
Well, you know that they can let you win by just moving their foot a little bit. See, I didn't know that at the time. As we moved from one marvel to the next, my brother and I began to list heavily to starboard. We hadn't stopped eating since we stepped onto the fairgrounds. Homemade popcorn balls, red, white, and blue, made by the 4-H Girl Scout cookies. French fries, boiled corn on the cob, dripping butter, knee-high orange, Heyer's root beer, peanuts, pumpkin pie, hot dogs, pickles, American Legion auxiliary crullers, baked beans on paper plates, lemonade, Ladies of the Moose angel food cake, taffy apples, and 1,000 free samples, including Purina Chick Chow, which my brother and I both ate avidly. Added to this was the real specialty of any Indiana fair, homemade black walnut chocolate fudge, displayed in thick, fly-crawling slabs at stands operated by beaming Kiwanians wearing funny hats and badges. We also scoffed down about 5 pounds each of peculiarly native candy called vanilla angel breath. You ever hear that? An airy concoction so cloyingly sweet that a bite-sized portion could rot teeth at 50 paces. A fundamental ground rule of the county fair was that kids could have anything they wanted to eat, just this once.
Yeah.
Steadily, we chewed our way toward Armageddon.
Yeah. And, of course, at the very end, there you are, cued you toward Armageddon.
You notice there's a hint of disaster, yeah. Armageddon.
Yeah, but something happens at the end.
That's right.
You had a certain...
See, in good storytelling, you should always hint all the way through the story that you're heading towards something that as you have not yet disclosed.
Toward disaster. I'm so sorry.
Disaster.
You know, I'm thinking, Gene, before I ask you about the Bumpus family, neighbors... yourself, you work out of New York City. This is actually in New York City. And yet, the following you have of young people, you sense an ache for something else outside that narrow pavement, don't you?
That's a good question and a very perceptive remark. I think all urban people do. I don't think there's a one of us that doesn't have a secret thing for... that place, whatever it is, it's like Oz. I think this is one of the reasons why Americans are so hung on Western movies. It's a dream world. I think this is one of the reasons why we've got this curious thing going about Indians. Somehow we always imagine Indians as sitting on a horse atop a lonely hill with the wind blowing. And actually, it's not true of Indians. And I think there's a nostalgia for an unlived past, even among people who've never lived outside of the city. It's a nostalgia
an unlived past. Isn't there something else, too? I'm wondering, here you working out of clubs, you know, in which you have your monologues or on the radio and people listen to you for hours and they're fascinated, of course. But many, I suppose, have come from smaller towns there, haven't they?
Well, middle-sized. Even if they haven't,
even
you know,
haven't,
there's a small-town myth in America. For example, if you remember the play Our Town by Thornton Wilder, well, most of the people who saw that play, of course, were New York urban people. It was a Broadway play. And yet they have this myth in their mind about the American small town. Now, I'm not saying it doesn't exist, but it's a mythological one in their mind, where people are simpler, where people are more honest. Of course, this is largely a myth, but they believe it.
There's a phrase you use, Gene, that hunger for an unlived past.
Unlived.
That's interesting, yeah.
See, so we you'll find a lot of... well, take the kids. A lot of kids today will be living in communes firmly convinced that they're living the way they lived in 1820.
Yeah.
And they collect 1820 calendars and stuff, and it's kind of sad because in 1820 they were living in an unlived past.
Yeah.
They were dreaming of the 1780s, all the way on back.
You know, since you are an observer of the scene, and you know, by the way, Gene Shepherd albums, of course, everyone who listens to Midnight Special has heard his human comedy, and of course the dates and the.
The
Chicago White Sox, of course, and the ill-starred adolescent romances. But we come back to something else here, the young, this longing. You sense this, of course, this throwback, even now, the granny dresses and granny glasses and this throwback.
See, I think the kids are the last conservatives.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's funny. The kids like to think they're progressive. Actually, it's curious that a good social psychologist is not interested in what a man says he is. He's interested in the way he acts.
Mm-hmm.
So if a person puts on an 1880 dress and grinds flour by hand and squats in the weeds and plants radishes, he knows that person is living out a fantasy of a past and gone time. In other words, they're conservative. They're worse. You remember when people used to think that Goldwater wanted to turn the time back to McKinley? These kids want to turn it back to Millard Fillmore.
Well, yeah. It may also be...
They make Goldwater look like an avant-garde...
Yeah. That's one aspect. And the other might be the... terrifying aspect of the present with whatever they sense
is true. Everybody's terrified by his life. Mm-hmm. Do you know? One of the saddest essays was written by a Greek historian. This was maybe 3,000 years ago, where he was weeping that the modern times, have grown so complex that man lives out his life in troubled uneasiness. I'm quoting it here. And that he longed for the days when things were simple and clean, like his father's day.
Mm.
And this is a continuing myth in man's life, and it's going to destroy us one day.
Well, of course,
because kids believe it. They really believe that it was easier, let's say, to go into World War II than to go into Vietnam.
Of course. You're talking now also about the good old days.
Death
and the
was
good
even
old days.
Easier in those days, they think.
Death was easy. I mean, death was certainly more frequent, too, in other ways. You know, coming back to, you know... Gene Shepherd, Wanda Hickey's Night of Golden Memories and Other Disasters. We've got to talk about... Do you call upon your Hammond memories a great deal, don't you?
Well, sure. After all, I think any writer does, and I know every writer has to write, if he's a serious writer, unless he's simply writing manufactured fiction, he has to write out of what he knows. Now, this is not all that I write. I mean, this happens to be a collection of stories about northern Indiana and Chicago. It's really Chicagoland. I combine Chicago and all that in it. And this is my background. After all, Faulkner had to write about Mississippi. A real writer writes about what he knows and lives in. Thomas Wolfe wrote about the Carolinas.
Asheville.
And
Nelson Algren, Chicago.
Chicago. Yeah. Now you take Philip Roth, he writes about New York. Mm-hmm. He's a New York kid. So this is his world. However, here's what I would like to say about that. You don't write autobiographical. My work is not autobiographical. No. You draw upon all the things that you knew from that period, that place, not that period so much, that place, the mores.
Yeah.
Like the town that I grew up in was a used car town. Now, that's an interesting statement of mores.
Used, Hammond is a used car town.
Well, they think in terms of a used car. Yeah. When my old man would stand in front of a show window of new Chevys, and he would imagine them 3 years from now, how they'd look as used cars.
That's very funny.
He never thought of himself owning a new car.
But describing it as a used car town immediately offers a flavor. Sets the flavor
sure,
right there.
Sure, Darien, Connecticut is not a used car town.
No. Those are the ad agency guys.
Well, it's just a different kind. Lake Bluff is not a used car town.
It isn't a question of economics either, is it?
No, it's a matter of attitude. It's like there are some guys that can make $100,000 a year and they still think of Robert Hall suits.
Yeah. The stuff because again it involves a certain kind of attitude. Okay, your neighbors, the Bumpuses. Now the first story deals with the passion play, the grandstand passion play, and the Bumpus family. Now this is their Delbert. Oh, now Delbert Bumpus was quite a guy. Also, who was the tough guy?
Well,
that was Emil.
Emil Bumpus was the old man. See, I remember there's a scene in there where Emil. And by the way, this is an actual memory out of my youth. Everybody in his life. If you've lived long enough, and you don't have to live very long either, have it happen to you, knows the fear of the really rotten neighbors moving in and lousing up everything. And moving in. You know, there's something, this real bad crowd moves in. Well, Emil Bumpus moves in, and this great ravening horde of hill people come in with a great crowd of dogs, and they brought their own pollution with them and everything. The Gene Autry records at 3 in the morning, and Emil Bumpus spitting tobacco juice out into our driveway, and my old man looking out seeing this. Well, one night, Emil Bumpus, there's a gigantic fight going on next door, a lot of yelling, and suddenly Emil Bumpus, the father, comes roaring out of the back door. He says, "I've had enough of this!" With that, he grabs the back porch and pulls it off the house. That is a man.
That's a man.
And they never replaced it. The door was always halfway up the wall, and once in a while, one of them would fall out of it.
But I was thinking, Gene, after they left, they moved. You kind of missed them, didn't you?
Yes, of course. We always miss our enemy. I suspect that guys, a lot of angry old 1930s type Republicans miss FDR. And I'm sure that a lot of 1960 angry militants miss Johnson.
I think you have a point here.
Because you're no good unless you've got somebody to fight.
But there's also something else here. The old dragon. The dragon is now an old man. The dragon of the past. The one you fought all the time. You see him as an old man. It's an experience I've had in working on the Depression. I want to come back to the people of the world of Gene Shepard. Really, the people of our world. Scott, we gotta have. There's always a Scott Farkas in everybody's life. And that's the murderous Mariah. That's his top. Oh, you describe this weapon or this instrument.
Well, that's a symbolic story. I hate to use that pompous phrase, but all of our lives, we're engaged in a kind of game. Now, the game may be, and it's usually your job. You're engaged in doing this radio show, but you're always vaguely aware of mysterious, dangerous forces around you. The station may get sold. and Scott Farkas moves in and takes over. This guy with yellow eyes. And now. Everybody has this thing back of him, and the kids have named it, quote, the establishment. It does not exist. It's the thing that's always behind you. So, what is the game? Well, the game is what we're doing in this context. So, if you're working at the International Widget Company, the game is making widgets. Nobody gives a damn about widgets.
Sort of a Parkinson's law applying.
Exactly,
here, too,
but they're making widgets.
Yeah, yeah.
See, so this is their game. And one guy's in charge. He wins in the widget game.
Uh-huh.
That's Bullard.
Yeah. Oh, Bullard.
Scott Farkas, or C.G. Bullard.
Now, Bullard is always the winner, isn't he?
Oh, yeah. Well, not the winner, the leader.
The leader. And this is, what we're doing here is just touching on some of the gems.
Bullard is the eternal boss, and all of the people under him are in deadly fear of him, even though they all call him C.G. and How Are You, Charlie?
Yeah.
And he's famous for the fact that he pulls his own teeth.
Oh, that gives him, of course, he's machismo there.
Can you imagine the guy that pulls his own teeth?
And that's Bullard. And, you know, we have to talk about vacations, too, vacations. Think of Natty Ali Hop Noodle's Haven of Bliss. And the vacation you're on.
Well, that's another American ritual. Yeah. Everybody, when I say to any American the 2-week vacation, you know, this is not a common thing in Europe. Their attitude towards vacation is very different. The Americans think of this great moment that comes once every 52 weeks when they pack up the car and they go to a place.
Yeah.
And that is as ritualized and as stylized as anything we do in our lives.
You know something? As you're talking, and there are many thoughts coming to my mind as Gene Shepherd, my guest, is talking. And the basis of the conversation is his new book, Wanda Hickey's Night of Golden Memories and Other Disasters, that Doubleday's put out, as well as a new...
It's a bestseller. It's on the Time bestseller list, and I can't tell you how astounded I am.
You are. I was thinking of something, though. And also, the declassified Gene Shepherd, the new Mercury album, which we'll hear for the remainder of this program, excerpts. But I want to come back to me. You mentioned a place. That's very funny. The word, a place. It's a looking, a seeking. You also speak of, what's the other thing on my mind? You're talking about ritual, that's it. So what you're doing is you're, in a way, you're recounting through your own imagination and a combination of imagination and actual memory, a ritual, rituals we live by.
Very right. We live by the vacation, the holiday, the prom, the graduation, the wedding, the reception, the big Sunday afternoon dinner. Many, many families right now are thinking about what they're going to have for dinner Sunday afternoon. The American Sunday dinner is a ritual. We don't recognize our own rituals.
You know, it's interesting. We're forgetting, very often it's true, forgetting the accepted way in which people live in any society, no matter what that society is, where the great many people live, what the conversation really is when you hear a couple of women talking, you know, aside from some startling headline, some horrendous headline. But generally speaking, the conversations about the rituals you've been talking about.
Yeah. I wonder how many... there are new rituals coming into being. For example, the coffee break is as ritualistic from one end of the country to the other. You know, you go into an office in Tacoma, and they're sitting around with these paper cups, and the coffee tastes exactly the same. The looks on the faces are the same. And it's a ritual, just as much as the English tea time ritual. See, we're getting to the point now in our country, we're 200 years or better old, where we're developing a specific set of recognizable American rituals, which makes us genuinely a nationality now. That I think in the next 100 years, people will no longer in America call themselves Greek Italians or Italian Americans or German Americans.
More homogenized is going to be.
No, they'll be just.
You mean more identity? You know, a more definite identity.
Definitely,
even though it is 200 years old, that identity is not yet established.
And most people only 2 or 3 generations removed. You know, but by the late 21st century, they'll be maybe 200, 300, 400 years removed.
Yep.
And by that time, you know, you go to England and the tea ritual is as, even the Beatles, you know, observe the tea ritual. I travel with the Beatles. They go out for tea. Just as much as the old ladies, and so. The coffee break ritual in America is a specific American thing.
Yeah. I think, you know, with Gene Shepherd as guest, and this is, again, it's...
I love America, as you can tell.
Of course. By the way, you were doing a series on NDT for a while in America, weren't you?
13 weeks. A very successful series. Yeah.
And this is the point of Gene Shepherd, to me, is the humor, but certain kind of humor. It's not the gag. It's the humor, picky of the young, of someone growing up. Basically, it's the aches and pains of growing up. You talk about too.
Yeah, not really though. Yes and no. You know, it's funny that a lot of the humor is about the grown-ups, the people.
Yeah.
See, I think our lives. There's two ways that you can look at life. I think there are two ways writers look at lives. There's the writer who looks at life as essentially a tragedy, and a battle. This is Norman Mailer. It's a fight. Then there's another kind, a much rarer writer, who looks at life, and I think he has a broader vision than a guy like Mamre. He looks at life as essentially a cosmic comedy, the human comedy.
The very fact that
he laughs at a thing like the Vietnamese War, because it's funny. It's a typical.
Well, at the same time, horrendous.
Of course, but that's why you laugh at it.
You're laughing
at the horrendous. I'm not laughing.
You're talking about the absurdity now, the nature
exactly.
of the absurd. Of course, it seems to me your time is returning. It seems we hear more and more of the nature of absurd, the absurdity that is within life itself. Whether it's Samuel Beckett is very funny. Horrendous, though, but funny.
Tremendously funny writer. I think the fact that just a season or two ago, of all people, Don Quixote was a star in a Broadway musical.
So, Gene Shepard. Also, the other thing, a place. And I think I have to say to you, Gene, that you are Midwest. Oh. I mean, though you work out of New York,
the core.
You are Midwest.
Well, we always remain
a place.
We are.
And it wasn't
Johnny Carson remains Kansas.
Yeah, it wasn't accidental either that you anthologized George Ade.
Oh, no. I think Ade is one of the great unrecognized influential writers of, let's say the beginning of the middle of the 20th century. Ade really influenced a lot of people. And you know who told me this one day? I'll never forget. It was S.J. Perlman. And I began to be interested in Ade. You know, he's from Chicago. Ade Railroad from Indiana. How many people know that the Purdue Stadium is named after Ade?
Stadium,
Ross Ade Stadium is George Ade, a great writer. And Ade wrote in Chicago for a long time, and he was so modest in his writings, you know, that Perlman signed his name to him. He was just doing staff work. And anyway, what I meant to say about Ade was that I think Ring Lardner said it best about Ade. He was interviewed in the 20s, and Lardner was asked, as all humorists are asked, who's your favorite, who do you think is the greatest humorist? And he says, I suppose you think I'm going to say Twain. And he says, I'm not. He says, I never meet Huck Finn. I've never met Huck Finn on the street anywhere. He says, I've never met Tom Sawyer. But I meet George Ade's characters 1,000 times a day.
As indeed, I think we meet Ring Lardner's characters, might I add.
And I hope mine.
I was just about to say.
Gene
Shepard. And it's all too short, this visit. We've got to have another one. I thought, Gene, as you're leaving now, because you have engagements, it's Gene's book, Wanda Hickey's Night of Golden Memories and Other Disasters. We've hardly touched on Doubleday published, and it's Gene Shepard's people, indeed you might say our people, everybody's, as well as the album. What do you suggest for the remainder of the program, your favorites, all are, of the declassified Gene Shepard?
Well, would you like to hear me head thump?
Head thump.
Yes. I do a beautiful head thump solo. You know, that's my instrument, my primary musical instrument. I am. I'm a professional head thump.
We'll fade on the matter of head thumping. He does it on the album. But I thought for the second half of the program, after we hear from Paul Wodeka and word from our sponsors, some early Gene Shepard, The Human Comedy, The White Sox Story, as well as a couple of columns of Mike Royko, one, Abby's Irish Rose that appeared last week and one this morning about health and City Hall, and a column Saturday of Arthur Hoppe about A Guide to the Scrutable West. So in a moment, the second half of the program, after we hear from Paul Wodeka.
You're listening to Studs Terkel on WFMT in Chicago. Studs presented each Monday morning by H.C. Nahigian and Sons on Golf Road in Skokie. There is a special collection of hand-loomed rugs from the Orient now at H.C. Nahigian and Sons, and the rugs are specially priced as well to make them outstanding values. You'll find Saruks, Kashans, and Herez from Iran, Bokhara rugs from Pakistan, and luxurious Shalimar rugs from India. One of the room-sized rugs in this special collection could add beauty to nearly any room in your home and save you money in the bargain. In addition, H.C. Nahigian and Sons are featuring scores of striking accent rugs, a number of Shiraz, Bijars, Bokharas, Chinese, and many others. They can provide the center for a conversational grouping of furniture, be placed before the hearth, beneath a coffee table, or even used as an eye-catching wall decoration. It's worth your while to pay a leisurely visit to the pleasant showrooms of H.C. Nahigian and Sons, where you'll find the largest collection of Oriental and domestic rugs on the North Shore. H.C. Nahigian and Sons are at 5140 Golf Road, just west of Old Orchard in Skokie. For information, phone Orchard 6-2500. Now back to you, Studs.
Well, after we'll hear for the second half of the program a couple of Gene Shepard monologues. But first, a Mike Royko column that appeared in the Daily News last Thursday, I believe. And this column has two portraits. The faces are familiar, you can't quite make them out. One is a bearded guy the wild hair, but as you look at the face carefully, you see it is none other than a congressman who is candidate for United States Senator. And below it says, Abby? Question mark. Next to him is a picture of someone you think you recognize, though he has Fu Manchu mustache and sort of glasses and wild Afro-type hair. And then you look close, you see, it is none other than himself, our city's number one citizen, our local Buddha. And down below it says, Rennie? And the column is headed, When Abby's Irish Rose. And it goes thus. This is Royko of last Thursday. I have received what may be a copy of a secret British intelligence report on outside agitators who are helping finance the strife in Northern Ireland. Much to my surprise, two of these agitators are believed to be operating here in Chicago. The report identified them as Rennie Daly and Abby Puchinsky. Both were described as being, quote-unquote, devilishly clever. Here is what the intelligence report said about them. Subject 1. Rennie Daly, U.S. citizen, resident Chicago, occupation, political activist. Method of operation? The subject has carefully established a cover as a middle-class advocate of, quote-unquote, law and order. See file on 1968 civil rights riots and subsequent shoot-to-kill order. Also see 1968 file on anti-war demonstrations and statements concerning, quote-unquote, outside agitators. The subject has also cultivated the appearance of a conservative in some areas of American civil rights activities. See 1963 file on Chicago ghettos and statement, there are no ghettos in Chicago. He has also presented the pose of a fervent supporter of swift and hard police actions. See a 1969 file on Black Panther raid. In the past, the subject has also used as a cover the position of a hawk so far as U.S. involvement in Vietnam was concerned. These covers have been highly effective and won him wide public acceptance. Present activities. Subject Rennie Daly, has recently abandoned the above-documented cover and has emerged as a supporter of Irish activists in the North Countries, in the North Counties. Until recently, his mission has been to raise funds among Americans. The funds were then transported to Ireland. The funds were said to be for relief of the needy. However, no accounting of the final disposition has been made public. At least $25,000 of these funds were hand-carried to Ireland by an aide of Rennie Daly, known as, quote-unquote, Colonel Riley. Riley is a known IRA sympathizer. In 1971, he stated, I would serve in the IRA as a private. Confidential IRA sources said that if Riley were in the IRA, he would indeed be a private. The subject, Rennie Daly, is known to have once extended an invitation to Bernadette Devlin to meet with him in Chicago. Miss Devlin is an admitted Marxist revolutionary who has urged Irish followers to kill English, quote-unquote, pigs. Daly asserted that the purpose of the proposed meeting was simply to offer Miss Devlin, quote-unquote, a cup of tea. He had in the past carefully maintained his cover, but never offering a cup of tea to American revolutionaries. Most recently, subject Rennie Daly has emerged as an outside agitator as well as a fundraiser. On February 1, 1972, he publicly stated that the British troops in Northern Ireland were, quote-unquote, stormtroopers. This was a significant departure from his cover, since he has in the past spoken favorably of various National Guard and other troops who have been used to combat American rioting. Nor did he utter any words of sympathy for the 47 British troops who have been killed thus far. He also agitated for the withdrawal of British troops, calling for worldwide public opinion to turn against England, and decried the internment of known and suspected IRA terrorists. These positions were contrary to his cover views on parallel situations in the United States. Subject 2. Abby Puchinsky, U.S. citizen, residence, Chicago, occupation, office seeker. Method of operation? It is believed that subject 2 works under the direct control of Rennie Daly. In the past, his cover has been quite similar. Outwardly, he has maintained a pose favoring law and order. He was an ardent spokesman for the presence of U.S. troops in Vietnam and favored massive bombing. He has been a conservative on the civil rights of American minority groups, and he has publicly supported the military dictatorship in Greece. Present activities. Abby Puchinsky has emerged as an active outside agitator of Irish civil strife. On February 12, 1972, he urged Americans to disrupt the British economy by boycotting British products, thus aiding Irish activists. In haranguing a crowd, Abby Puchinsky said, There is a depression in England now. There are a million unemployed. Maybe we want to help it along a bit. Unquote. Puchinsky, whose former cover included favoring the use of napalm in Vietnam, told his followers that the British were practicing genocide upon Irish Catholics. Recommended counteractivities. Two steps are recommended by intelligence agents. First, to counter the activities of Rennie Daly, the Lord Mayor of London should establish a Chicago Relief Fund, which would be used for the benefit of Black Panthers, Weathermen, and other revolutionary groups using tactics similar to those of the IRA. The Lord Mayor of London should also publicly condemn Chicago public housing, ghettos, and other such internment camps. The Lord Mayor should be urged by agents to condemn Chicago, quote-unquote, stormtroopers. This we believe will effectively divert Rennie Daly in his outside agitation. Step two, we believe Abbey Puchinsky can be rendered inactive in a much simpler, more direct way. The Intelligence Department's petty cash fund can be used for a campaign contribution. He has the potential to be a double agent. And thus we have Mike Royko's column last Thursday. And in that vein, a colleague of Mike who works in San Francisco for the Chronicle, Arthur Hoppe, and whose column is occasionally carried by the Daily News, had one last Saturday. And it was just below the column of the former publisher of the News, John Knight. And John Knight spoke of the inscrutable Zhou Enlai. And you may be reading the papers today and the headlines, a reporter speaking of the coolness and somehow dismayed by the strange behavior of the Chinese. I refer to Peter Lissiger and to Cronkite and the other profound pundits of the scene. Observers of the scene. And this is Arthur Hoppe, last Saturday's Chicago Daily News. It goes, A Guide to the Scrutable West. President Nixon has thoroughly prepared himself in his negotiations for his negotiations in Peking, reading a number of books on the Far East, including, presumably, the invaluable An American Guide to Mysterious China. Meanwhile, of course, Chairman Mao Zedong has been boning up on the U.S., to give you some idea of the thinking he will bring to the conference table if he comes, here are excerpts from the work he has reportedly been studying the hardest. It is called A Chinese Guide to Mysterious America. For more than a quarter of a century, the guide begins, America has shut herself off from the outside socialist world. Only recently has this sleeping giant begun to stir. What has been going on all these years behind what is known as the plastic curtain? First of all, America watchers in Havana and Ottawa report there was an attempt at a great cultural revolution in U.S. under the Kennedys in the early 1960s. But this ended disastrously in a series of assassinations, demonstrations, and bloody riots throughout the country. Since then, the picture has been confused. But today, America is obviously in the throes of a vast and mysterious political struggle. Chairman Nixon faces open opposition from Kennedy revisionists. The whereabouts of some of those once closest to him, for example, Robert Finch and Murray Chotiner, are presently unknown. The number two man is now believed to be one Henry Kissinger, though he holds no high official position whatsoever. Also mentioned is someone known as B.B. Rebozo, of whom little is known. As to the people, Americans are generally docile, easily led, unthinking automatons. This reflects the ant-like culture in which they live. Every morning they breakfast on a bowl of rice or wheat cereal, and then trudge off to work in teeming masses, clogging all methods of transportation. They not only look alike with their big noses, but they dress alike. It would be difficult to tell a lowly clerk from Chairman Nixon himself by their dress alone. Nixon has a bigger nose. They share a common dislike of thinking. For instance, their favorite occupation is watching football on television. For after each play, the announcer explains to them what happened. Similarly, every time Chairman Nixon makes a speech, three men immediately appear on the screen to explain what he said. Thus, the people are easily governed by simple slogans. One sees them on posters everywhere and hears them dinned over the government-controlled airwaves constantly. Typical of the many current mass campaigns to better the environment is Stop Perspiration Wetness. But while the people are dull and sheep-like, their leaders, with their legendary inscrutability, make clever negotiators. They have but one weakness, to exploit. It is this weakness alone that has kept them mired down all these years in Vietnam at great cost of lives and treasure. This weakness, so difficult for the Oriental mind to understand, is, of course, the Americans' almost paranoid fear of losing face. That's Arthur Hoppe. So I thought these two columns, one of Royko, one of Hoppe, are marvelous examples of what Thorne Smith once described as turnabout. Turnabout being fair play, indeed. And I thought now we'd hit Gene Shepherd again, and appropriate enough, the human comedy in one of his earlier records.
You hear something? What is that? It's music. It's a parade. Look at the parade coming. It's a parade. I love parades. Who's that guy there in the front, leading it, on the big horse? It's Richard the Lionhearted. It's really him. Richard the Lionhearted. He's scratching himself. Hey, Dick! Hey, Lionhearted! What do you call him? Hey, Richard the Lion! Hey, Hearted! It doesn't look. It's Richard the Lion. Who's that following him there? That little guy with the fur rug. That little show. It's Attila the Hun! Hey, Hun! What do you call him? Hey, Attila! He's a little guy. What about the shrimp? I thought he was a big guy. What were they afraid of? Hey, Hun! He's scratching himself. There is Beowulf! From the club. Hey, Beowulf! Beowulf! I wonder if he killed that. Hey, did you really kill that bear? I'm just saying, what a parade. This is great. Look, there's Jonathan Swift. Hey, Mr. Swift! John! He's giggling. He was supposed to be mad. What's he giggling? Hey, Jonathan Swift! Mr. Swift, what's the gag? Doesn't look. What a trick. There goes Disraeli. Look at Disraeli! Disraeli! I never knew you could twirl a baton! Hey, Disraeli! He's dancing. This is the greatest parade I ever saw. Hey, hey! Did you hear somebody? You don't look. There is Minnie Mouse. She's wearing those funny lady shoes. Hey, Minnie, I used to be a fan of yours. Whatever happened to her? Minnie, where's Mickey? There she goes. This is a wonderful parade. All the great people of the world going right past here. I never thought they'd go past this corner. Eric the Red, for crying out loud. He's bald. What a phony. Hey, Eric! Eric! Hey, Baldy! Hey, Red! What a bonus bonus. I'll bet he never did have red hair. There goes. There is U.S. Grant, President Grant. Hey, President, U.S. General! To the ears. I thought it was just a story. Look at him. This is awful. I'm in a parade. Cotton Mather! Cotton Mather! Shh, don't say anything. He might see us. Billy Budd. Hey, Billy! Billy's carrying a flag that says Excelsior. Hey, Billy, you got a rotten deal! Billy! He doesn't look. What a handsome job. What a handsome job. Look, there goes Lady Godiva. Look what the horse did! You think they could train the horses better for a parade? Hey, Lady Godiva! Oh, for crying out loud, she's wearing tights. Oh, after all this time, what a disappointment. This is the greatest parade. There goes Captain Kidd. He never made Major. Hey, wait for me! Hey, I want to go! He never looked. I want to... Hey, wait for me! Wait! I want to be with you! All the great people! Wait! Wait! I'm great too! Wait! Wait!
Hey, wait for me. I'm great too. Wait, wait. The universal, the eternal, the human cry. Look at me. Royko again, today's Daily News, and then we'll follow with Shepherd's memories of the Chicago White Sox a month or so before the, couple months before the bowl season begins. Today's Royko. I should call him up for permission to read this, really, but we'll run the risk. It's called Healthy Side, this is a health column, Healthy Side of City Hall. It goes, a recent medical study has confirmed that which many of us suspected. Working in City Hall can be very good for you. Everybody has known that it can be good for a person's economic health, and even good for the well-being of a brother, an uncle, and all of the offsprings that can be enrolled on a payroll. But now it has been found that working in City Hall is good for a person's physical health. It can give you a longer life. A study conducted by the Harold Brun Institute of Cardiovascular Research, San Francisco, shows that city employees are much less likely to suffer heart attacks than are people in many other occupations. This might surprise the casual visitor to City Hall because so many people in the building appear to have been stricken by heart attacks or something that renders them motionless. At a city council meeting, for instance, several aldermen always look as if they have already been administered the last rites. But if you watch them closely, you will see that their breathing is regular. And eventually, when the day's labor is done, they will open their eyes, rise slowly, put on their hats, and go home to rest. Their resistance to heart attacks probably explains why so many people in local government offices appear to be of advanced age. Even the younger ones soon learn to move very slowly, take short steps, and drop off into naps. Many men in their 70s and 80s have occupied the top political offices and leadership positions in the machine. At one time, the youngest member of the Cook County Board had qualified for Social Security. The board's regular meetings never began until an aide held a mirror near the lips of the commissioners. In one respect, the advanced age of Chicago's politicians was puzzling because it defied one of the long-accepted rules for having a healthy heart, getting regular exercise. You wouldn't think there would be any health benefits in shaking a few hands, waving a finger while saying, "Hi, Keed," or even lifting a heavy wallet. But the Brun Institute's study seems to explain that. The study found that there are basically two kinds of people, which it calls A people and B people. The A people are those who are always on the go, under pressure, nervous, pushing, trying to excel, worrying, fretting, nervously twitching, impatient, aggressive. These kinds of people keep the ambulance crews busy. On the other hand, the B people have a more leisurely approach to life. They take things in stride. They don't get nervous. They're patient about solving problems. They are the me worry people. City employees are found to be extreme examples of easygoing B people. This finding won't surprise anyone who has watched a city crew calmly studying a chuck hole in the street, wondering when it will miraculously repair itself, or gathered together to ponder the sight of a dead tree, calculating what the odds are that maybe it will just fall off on its own, fall over on its own. At the other extreme, the study found, are people in my line of work who are considered among the twitchingest of A people and are foolish to plan more than one vacation ahead? One reason for this may be that newsmen spend so much of their professional lives observing the eye-popping antics of those in and around City Hall. One day, it will be the amazing assessor's office, and then the remarkable racetrack stock, and the incomparable indictments, and then the colossal cash-filled closet. The constant excitement gets to be too much for a body to stand. Although the report doesn't say so, it would not surprise me if most of the fretful A people are those who pay the taxes to finance the leisurely but profitable long lives of the B types. Working in City Hall may be fine, but working for City Hall can become backbreaking. And so that's Mike Royko's health report in this afternoon's Daily News. And we have Gene Shepherd and Memories of the White Sox.
Baseball, in so many ways, is truly an American expression. Well, I am living out in the Midwest, and the Chicago White Sox have been for over 100 years in the second division. They owned it. They owned the second division. We used to resent it when a team would be in eighth place and the White Sox were out of it, you know. It was like, it was just unnatural. You just felt rotten, you know. It was like somebody's getting pushy, see. So the White Sox were the last place ball club. Well, suddenly out of the middle of the Depression, the White Sox developed a colorful ball player. Now, color on a bad ball team consists of being worse. Not like on a good ball team. Color consists of being Mickey Mantle, you know. Color consists of being somebody like... Well, who is... All right, I'll give you one guess. Who in the entire history of the Mets ball club was by far the most colorful ball player?
Marv.
Who?
Marv.
Marvelous Marv. Have you ever seen Marvelous Marv with that concrete glove out there? You know? Wait a minute, you know? Oh, yeah, Marvelous Marv grew to be loved by the Mets fans because he was aggressive about his ineptitude. You know? The others would fight against it. They'd cover it up. But Marv, when, let me tell you, when Marv made a bad throw from first over to third, believe me, it was Upper Decksville, you know? That was Marv. Well, the White Sox developed a ball player. It used to be a pleasure to go out and see him. He was without question the worst left fielder who ever played baseball. No, he really was. But the reason he played, he was an instinctive hitter. He had absolute impeccable instincts. He was a 350 hitter when he felt like it. When he was kidding around, 320. You know, that kind of thing. And he'd play around at bat. You know, he'd come up there with the bats. He used to do a thing with his hips, you know, like this. He'd come up and he'd go like that. He'd wave at the audience. He would do a takeoff on some of the more prominent denizens of Greenwich Avenue. You know what I mean? And, oh, that used to make Feller mad, you know. Oh, it made those guys mad that he didn't take the game seriously. He'd play around, you know. He gets up there. And he'd do all kinds of bits, like he'd come up with his hat backwards. Well, you know, I mean, what are you going to say when a guy's batting? He's got the bill sticking out in the back. He'd get up there like that and hit. And, of course, the crowd loved it. He'd drill a triple down the left field line with his hat backwards. I never forget one time he hits a triple. Sure, a triple. You know, he belched one out there, and then he goes down pretending he's got a wooden leg. You know, oh, Jimmy Dykes came out of the dugout. You, that's $100, you idiot! I'll tell you, now what are you cheering? You know, the poor son of a gun was getting busted. It's $100. Well, one day, this is what had happened. One day, it was a hot day. I'm a patrol boy. You know, they used to let the Boy Scouts, the patrol boys, in free during the Depression because they figured that the back ends, the fannies of these kids would keep the seats clean. So we go in there, we'd sit down there, and one day, our left fielder makes three consecutive errors on three balls hit directly at him. I mean, you know, the kind of errors where he's circling under it like this, you know. He's circling, oh, like that. The last instant, you know, Donnie runs, hits the wall, and picks it up and throws it in the stand. You know, that kind of... Well, you see, and what was so sad about it is that the ball team was playing a fairly decent game, you know. Well, he was kicking it away, literally kicking it away, kicking the ball to everything. So finally, the score at the end of the eighth inning is something like 7-1. The pitcher that's pitching, you ought to be a pitcher on a second division team out of town. You have lost 19 games. You have won two. And you're up there, and you've got this left fielder. And you're losing another one to Detroit. And everything you throw, you have that little thing says, don't let him hit it to left field. That inhibits a guy. I'm telling you, it inhibits him. So in the eighth inning, score 7-1, somebody drills a ground ball, a single, right through short. It comes hopping along. The outfielder comes up to it, and suddenly he sees the ball. He gets one of his nutty ideas. He lays down in front of it. This one is not going to get past him. See? He lays down, and the whole crowd backs up, you know. And you can see Dykes rise up off the bench. You see his head going down. Here's the outfielder laying there. The ball is rolling at him, and he's got his glove. He's waiting. See, it's not going to go. The last instant, it takes a bad hop. Over him. All the way to the wall. Well, he gets up. The crowd is roaring. The runners are going around. It's a merry-go-round. You know, they're going. The guy that hit the ball, it's the longest triple he ever got, you know. And the outfielder gets up, picks up the ball, he's got it, and you won't believe it. It gets stuck in the webbing of his glove.
He can't. And so it goes. Gene Shepherd continues with White Sox memory. This isn't the band I had in mind, the one involving ball players' names, Dietrich and Tresh, in contrast to today's names. It was another band. This is our program for this morning. A variety of comments, mostly by Shepherd, some by Royko, and one by Hoppy. And after we hear from Paul Vodica, a word from our sponsor, we'll speak of tomorrow's program.
An Oriental rug is something that keeps its beauty and value for a long time, and hence it's something you don't buy on impulse. In buying an Oriental rug, you should deal with someone known for experience and expertise. Just such experience and expertise have made H.C. Nahigian and Sons on Golf Road in Skokie one of the most respected names in Chicago for Oriental rugs. In the large and pleasant H.C. Nahigian showrooms, there's always a wide selection of rugs from all the most important rug-weaving centers of the world. In addition, H.C. Nahigian and Sons pride themselves on their fine collection of domestic rugs and carpeting. You can depend on a great deal of pleasant browsing, friendly advice, and excellent values at H.C. Nahigian and Sons. They're at 5140 Golf Road, just west of Old Orchard in Skokie. For information, phone Orchard 6-2500. And for information on tomorrow's program, here again is Studs.
Well, tomorrow is February 22nd and is George Washington's birthday, no matter who says what to the contrary. And so our annual George Washington birthday program tomorrow, February 22nd, as usual. So until then, we say take it easy, but take it.
You have been listening to Studs Terkel, heard on WFMT each weekday beginning at 10 a.m. and on Thursday evenings at 8. Studs has been presented today, as each Monday, by H.C. Nahigian and Sons on Golf Road in Skokie. This is WFMT in Chicago. In one of those distinguished old homes which dot the near north side and help add to its atmosphere, there's a new French restaurant. It's called Le Mignon. The interior of the home that houses Le Mignon has remained virtually untouched, so you can be served in one of four very different and very intimate dining rooms on two floor levels, each with a warm, welcoming fireplace. The dinner menu features such specialties as tournedos Rossini, roast rack of lamb persillade for two, and poached filet of imported French tourbeau with almonds and grapes. And there's a casual bar on the lower level with piano music on weekends. One writer described Le Mignon as magnificent food in a magnificent home, unquote. Le Mignon serves luncheon Monday through Friday and dinner 7 days a week. The address is 712 North Rush Street. For reservations, phone Le Mignon at Mohawk 41033. Returning now to our scheduled music programming, we're going to hear in this period two symphonies of which two different versions exist. We'll begin with a symphony by Haydn, number 63 in C major, called La Roxolaine, that the original music was based on a play of that name.